You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, September 28th, 2020. I'm Ashley Frazier from Drake University. Here is our first story. Halloween Scavenger Hunt for Southwest Iowa by Heidi Hurtinson. With the possibility for many Halloween events to be canceled this year, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, a group of volunteers has found a safe way to have some spooktacular fun in Southwest Iowa with a painted rock Halloween scavenger hunt. The Kindness Rock Project, which can be described as a treasure hunt for both kids and adults, was started in 2015 on Cape Cod by Megan Murphy. Since then, the project has become more popular and numerous Facebook groups can now be found in conjunction with this project. The purpose of the project is to paint encouraging messages or images on rocks and place them around any town for people to find. Located on the bottom of the rock, it will list which Facebook group left the painted rock. The person finding the rock can then go to that Facebook page, join the group, and post a picture of the rock they found. They can then keep the rock or rehide it for someone else to find and track where it goes on that Facebook page. Anita Baker of Farragut started painting rocks as a hobby after retiring. With the looming threat of trick-or-treating being canceled this year, she wanted to find a safe way for kids to have some Halloween fun. Two Facebook groups, SWI Rocks and Clarinda Rocks, have incorporated the Kindness Rock Project idea into a Halloween scavenger hunt for Southwest Iowa. The group of volunteers will place three items into a baggie. There will be a painted rock, a pirate token, and a memo giving the information on what Facebook page to visit to log your find. The bags will then be hidden in towns within Page, Vermont, Montgomery, and Mills counties. The dates and towns where rocks will be hidden are as follows. Clarinda, October 1st through October 8th. Shenandoah, October 1st through October 8th. Red Oak, October 9th through October 13th. Glenwood, October 14th through October 20th. Farragut, October 21st through October 25th. Riverton, October 21st through October 25th. Hamburg, October 25th to October 30th. Sydney, October 25th to October 30th. Tabor, October 25th through October 30th. To qualify, a picture of the rock and token found in the bags must be posted on both SWI Rocks and Clarinda Rocks Facebook pages within the dates for each town. Baker said kids could go to multiple towns to search for the rocks. To post, Baker said you must join the Facebook groups to have access or have someone that is a member post them for you. Baker is working on putting together three Halloween baskets as prizes, which will go to the three kids finding and posting the most rocks. You must find at least five rocks and post a picture of the rock and token found in the bag to qualify to win one of the three prizes. Baker said prizes would be delivered to the winners. A map showing the towns and dates where rocks will be hidden can be found on both the SWI Rocks and Clarinda Rocks Facebook page. Baker said she's still looking for more volunteers to paint rocks, help hide rocks, and track the rocks that have been picked up and posted. She is also looking for additional donations for the prize baskets. To volunteer or donate, contact Baker by email at ambaker40@westiaNET.net or on Facebook. Officials brace for rush of mail ballots by Rod Bouchard. Des Moines lawmakers approved emergency authority Friday, allowing election officials to get a leg up in coping with an expected crush of absentee ballots for the November 3rd election. Expecting many more voters than usual to cast ballots absentees rather than go in person to the polls during the COVID-19 pandemic, the Legislative Council granted Republican Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate the authority to establish a procedure for officials around the state to begin preparing absentee ballots for counting early. Members of the Legislative Council, a state house steering committee when the Iowa legislation is not in session, voted 24-0 to provide the extraordinary powers to Pate in his capacity as the state election commissioner. He'll enact rules for speeding up the time-consuming process of opening mailed envelopes and separating the sealed ballots inside for processing on November 2nd, the day before the election. Under the emergency directive, county auditors will be able to mail absentee ballots to residents of health and long-term care facilities who request them. Allow all ID cards that have expired in 2020 to be considered current and valid for in-person absentee balloting and at election day polling places, and to allow absentee ballots to be opened but not counted during the weekend before the November 3rd election. The law already counts auditors to begin tabulating absentee ballots on November 2nd, said Molly Wyden, Pate's legal counsel. Therefore, if a county auditor takes advantage of the time on October 31st, they would likely be able to begin tabulating early on Monday before the election. Wyden also said that a curbside voting procedure has been established where eligible Iowans who wish to vote in person can do so even if they find themselves in a COVID-19 quarantine situation on November 3rd. Signs will be posted at each Iowa polling place designating an area for curbside voting with a telephone number the voter can call. A precinct official in protective gear will then come to serve the voter in his or her car. Pate has outlined security procedures in which absentee and special voters precinct boards may meet October 31st to open mailed-in affidavits received by county auditors and remove the secrecy envelope counting the ballot, but under no circumstances shall a secrecy ballot be opened before the board convenes to begin the tabulation of ballots on November 2nd, according to Pate's request. Each political party may appoint up to 5 representatives to observe the October 31st process, and if a ballot is not enclosed in a secrecy ballot or is folded in such a way that any of the votes cast on the ballot are visible, procedure is spelled out for placing a ballot in a sealed envelope. The request also would allow the Secretary of State to authorize the emergency relocation of polling place due to the pandemic in compliance with Governor Kim Reynolds' Public Health Disaster Emergency Proclamation. As of midday Friday, Pate said more than 583,000 Iowans have requested absentee ballots for the November 3rd election, a number that represents more than a third of the total votes cast in the 2016 election. Absentee balloting has grown significantly since 1988, when about 7% of Iowans voted absentee, according to the Secretary of State's website. Absentee ballots request forms were sent to active registered Iowa voters this month, and county auditors are slated to begin mailing ballots to those who requested them October 5th. I just want to give a shout out to Iowans for the amazing participation we've had this election so far, said Senator Janet Peterson, D. Des Moines, who serves on the council. She praised county auditors for adapting to the very difficult challenges in conducting a fair election during a pandemic that includes safe opportunities to vote by mail. Good and Healthy, What is CrossFit? By Drew Gooden. As you have read under my name, I own CrossFit Council Bluffs. What does that actually mean? How does CrossFit differ from all the other fitness programs? Is CrossFit a fad? Does CrossFit make me bulky? I want to learn how to lift weights, but I don't want to look like a man. I have a ton of injuries. Is CrossFit good for me? I get bombarded with these types of questions every time a curious new person walks through our door. They have usually been introduced to CrossFit by something they have seen on the internet or on ESPN. That first introduction is usually with professional athletes who compete in the sport of CrossFit. Similar to if you were to Google basketball or football, and the professionals of that sport are at the top of the search list. So now you may be wondering, CrossFit is a sport? Yes, it is, and has been around since 2008. This is just one piece that makes CrossFit such a unique fitness program. But the sport doesn't define what CrossFit is. It only is the expression of what CrossFit can do at the most extreme level. The sport inspires the fitness community to become something greater than what they originally thought possible, much like the NBA is an expression of basketball at the highest level. What does CrossFit actually mean? CrossFit is constantly varied, high-intensity functional movement. These are compound movements which involve universal motor recruitment patterns before performed in a wave of contractions from core to extremities. CrossFit aims to forge broad, general, and inclusive fitness. Movements for the grandmother and the Olympic athlete do not differ by the kind of movement, but the degree to which it needs to be performed to move the needle from sickness to wellness and ultimately to fitness. CrossFit believes in safety, efficacy, and efficiency and uses an evidence-based approach to fitness programming. CrossFit also recognizes the breadth and depth of a program stimulus will determine the breadth and depth of the adaptation it elicits. The prescription of functionality and intensity is constantly varied. CrossFit believes in preparation for random physical challenges, the unknown and the unknowable. The entire program is a paraphrased version taken right out of the CrossFit Level 1 training guide, which is studied by all CrossFit coaches in order to pass an exam to teach CrossFit and local CrossFit affiliates. CrossFit is not a franchise. It is an international corporation that provides guidance on how to live a happy and healthier life. Affiliates are small businesses that are usually started by someone in your community looking to improve the lives of those they come in contact with every day through fitness, wellness, and nutrition. What makes CrossFit different from other fitness programs? From my personal experience, my first perception of this was the attention to detail on movement instruction and the versatility of the programming itself. There is no other fitness program that is going to teach you the basics of Olympic-style weightlifting, fundamental gymnastics, powerlifting, rowing, running, jumping, and climbing all in one fitness program. When I first started coaching CrossFit, I noticed that we were training the personal trainers. We were the source of how to train in a way that progresses people towards fitness as long as the members consistently show up, receive information given, and put forth their best efforts. The community that is established within a CrossFit gym becomes a support web that ties you into the fitness journey by keeping you accountable and by surrounding you with like-minded individuals who become a positive force in your life. Debunking misconceptions. CrossFit general programming is meant to make you a fit person by taking a primal approach to fitness. With that, you are going to build muscle mass and lose fat mass. You will become more toned, which will give off the perception of strength. How far you want to take that fitness is up to you and the amount of time you would like to invest in the programming. For most, becoming bulky isn't in the cards because of time. We have jobs, kids, social events, and other miscellaneous things that will get in the way of spending more time on your fitness. Another big misconception is that CrossFit is bad for the joints of the body due to the nature of the movements. This could not be further from the truth. As mentioned above, CrossFit contains some of the most aware fitness trainers on the planet. The knowledge needed to teach CrossFit is broad and vast. We are not experts in one area. We have broad knowledge of fitness that was taught to us by the experts, not just online by looking up YouTube videos, although those can be valid sources at times. CrossFit takes the time to teach you how to do the movements necessary to keep you safe. Not all CrossFit gyms are created equal, however. We all have our unique backgrounds and expertise. Do your homework on the gym owner and their coaches to make sure you are getting the adequate instruction you need to be safe. Go into a gym and ask questions. Do a free session with a coach and to feel out the personality of the instructor and find out which one is best for you. CrossFit is truly for everyone, but not every CrossFitter is created equal either. The ability of one is different from another by virtue of experience. We are the sum of our experiences, and there is a CrossFit coach out there for you who can fit your needs. But it may take a couple of tries to find the right one for you and your goals. What is CrossFit? CrossFit means something unique to each and everyone who chooses it as their fitness program. To me, it's the most holistic approach in current times to help people live happier and healthier lives. It does this by supporting our social, physical, intellectual, spiritual, and emotional health. CrossFit has brought people to physical accomplishments for just as many as 60-plus-year-olds as it has for those in their 20s, and challenges people to continue the pursuit of mastery on not only physical bouts, but also oneself. It's brought people together and broken down barriers across the entire world. It's given the stay-at-home mom a newfound confidence. It's brought strength to a grandmother to continue to play with her grandchildren. It's built up a double open heart surgery survivor. It's created foundations to support a population in need. It's steered people away from the addiction of drugs to the addiction of fitness. CrossFit is just a word, though. A word that is ultimately defined by the people who invest in it daily. The community is where the magic is, and the science is in the programming. Christian Home Association / Children's Square USA hosting fundraiser at Topgolf. The Christian Home Association / Children's Square USA is hosting its annual chip-in for children event from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. Thursday at Topgolf, 908 North 102 Second Street in Omaha. This yearly event is usually held in the spring, but was postponed due to COVID restrictions, event coordinator said through a news release. Holding our event at Topgolf allows us to continue our golf tradition while still providing for socially distancing and precautionary measures, said Cheryl Clark, Vice President of Resource Development at Children's Square. Topgolf has gained national popularity with its indoor-outdoor driving range, climate-controlled hitting bays, and lively atmosphere. Omaha Topgolf opened in July and is the only facility of its kind within the Council Bluffs, Omaha area. The Children's Square fundraiser kicks off at 5:30 p.m. and includes food and beverages, a silent auction of sports-themed items, and opportunities for a hole-in-one prize of $10,000, the release says. Clark added, "The Topgolf experience allows everyone from the experienced golfer to those who have never golfed to have a great evening with a lot of fun. We welcome you to join us." Proceeds from the event will directly benefit the children and families in need who are in the care of Children's Square. Those planning to attend the golf event are asked to RSVP by calling 712-325-5843. Children's Square is a nonprofit organization that has operated for 137 years in Council Bluffs to care for children and families in need. Over 1,000 children and families are served daily through early childhood care and educational programs, counseling services, emergency services for children, residential treatment for children and adolescents, and support of foster and adopted families in both Iowa and Nebraska. Children's Square is located at North 6th Street and Avenue East. State's Best Burger, Twisted Tail in BB Town, recognized by Iowan Cattlemen, by Sam Pimper. Photo: Brian Tesmer poses for a portrait holding a Swiss mushroom burger and the B Town burger inside Twisted Tail Steakhouse and Saloon in BB Town on Friday, September 25th, 2020. The eatery was named Iowa's Best Burger by the Iowa Cattlemen's Association. The contest, sponsored by the Iowa Beef Industry Council and the Iowa State Beef Checkoff Program, is in its 11th year. Though arguably better known for its award-winning ribs, it turns out the Twisted Tail Steakhouse and Saloon in BB Town makes a pretty mean burger too. Recently, the eatery, positioned about 20 miles north of Council Bluffs, was named Iowa's Best Burger by the Iowa Cattlemen's Association. The contest, sponsored by the Iowa Beef Industry Council and the Iowa State Beef Checkoff Program, is in its 11th year. The first phase of the competition was entirely based on votes from the public, according to information provided by the Iowa Beef Industry Council. For a month, starting in February, burger connoisseurs were online and voted for their favorite Iowa burger, submitting nearly 7,000 votes representing around 630 restaurants. At the end of March, the 10 restaurants with the most votes were declared the top 10. From there, three anonymous judges visited each restaurant, focusing on the burger patties and scoring them based on taste, doneness, and presentation, information from the council says. The final judging occurred in August and September, and the winner was revealed on September 21st. the restaurant owned by Ed and Ruth Spencer and operated by their two of their three children, Hannah Johnson and Luke Spencer, previously made it in the top 10 portion of the competition two times. This year, though, the Twisted Tale made it over the hump and secured the coveted first spot. "It was really exciting," Johnson said during an interview with the Nonpareil. "To be quite honest, with COVID and everything, we were closed to do takeouts for 6 weeks after the governor shut down in-person dining. With that came a lot of changes with help. So we went through some major changes with cooks and stuff like that, trying to hold everything together. So we were kind of surprised, just because we were more concerned about just keeping our help and stuff like that." Previous winners of the Iowa Cattlemen's Competition are Cool Bowl III, Coon Rapids 2012, Chop House Grill, Minneapolis 2013, Brick City Grill, Ames 2014, Cider House Fairfield 2015, Chug Wagon Restaurant, Adair 2016, Smokin' Hereford Barbecue, Storm Lake 2017, Cafe Bedeglaire, Ames 2018, and Wood Iron Grill, Oskaloosa 2019. The menu at Twisted Tale features burgers served in 11 styles, from conventional to little more colorful, like the restaurant's AM burger, featuring bacon, beef, egg, and cheese. Each burger is made with an 8-ounce patty. "The beauty of the burger creation at their core," Johnson said, "is their overall simplicity. A lot of it is just the product," she said, "of what makes a superior burger. The locally sourced beef, a very, very simple, obviously secret, seasoning, and then you have to give a lot of credit to our cooks who know how to make them right." When Johnson's parents opened Twisted Tale in 2011, the family was new to the restaurant industry. The family has always kept busy in the town from just under 1,000 people, farming and running a real estate auction company. But running a kitchen and turning out quality eats was something new. Twisted Tale was first recognized for its mouth-watering ribs at the Iowa State Fair in 2013, winning first prize in the Farm Beret Kickoff. Now, it's burgers taking the blue ribbon. "It means a lot because we have put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in it," she said, "of the business. I feel like it's well-deserved, and I don't even know how to put it into words, but we are very, very overwhelmed and happy." The restaurant's hours are from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Wednesday through Sunday. Reservations are encouraged for evening dining at the Twisted Tale at 849 335th Street, Missouri Valley. Rue Elementary School named National Blue Ribbon School by Tim Johnson. District and school officials posed for a portrait with students outside James B. Rue Elementary School in Council Bluffs on Friday, September 25th, 2020. Rue was recently named a National Blue Ribbon School for 2020 for being an exemplary high-performing school. James B. Rue Elementary School in Council Bluffs has been named a National Blue Ribbon School for 2020 for being an exemplary high-performance school. Rue was one of six Iowa schools recognized Thursday by the U.S. Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos. Vicki Murillo, superintendent of Council Bluffs Community Schools, was pleased by the announcement. "I am so proud of the work by our entire school community to enhance student achievement," she said. "The Rue Elementary staff, under the leadership of Mr. Morin, focuses on continuous improvement in their teaching to help every student achieve, and this designation shines a spotlight on their efforts, as well as on our school district and community." The school was nominated for the honor by the Iowa Department of Education in February because it ranked in the top 15% of Iowa schools in demonstrating sustainable academic growth in English/language arts and math. Rue placed in the high performing category on the Iowa School Performance Profiles in the latest report released in January. It was the second year in a row the school had been rated at high performing. "Our Rue team strives for excellence every day," Warren said. "This recognition honors the hard work and dedication of our outstanding staff and students with the support of our parents. This nomination is evidence of the district's focus on high quality instructional practices, an engaging curriculum, and the practice of holding all students to high standards." Rue's average student growth percentile in math on the Iowa statewide assessment of student progress was 72.5, and its average growth percentile in reading was 69.5. Statewide, the percentage of students proficient in math on the assessment was 71.64%, and the percentile scoring proficient in language arts was 61.94%. The National Blue Ribbon School Recognition Program is part of a larger U.S. Department of Education effort to identify and disseminate knowledge about effective school leadership and promising instructional practices. The award affirms the hard work of educators, families, communities in creating safe and welcoming schools where students master challenging and engaging content. When schools win the award, they are not eligible for nomination again for 5 years. Schools must be nominated by the top education officials in their state. The 2020 National Blue Ribbon Schools Award Ceremony will be held virtually on November 12th to November 13th. The event will recognize the 317 public and 50 non-public schools honored this year. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, September 28th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Ashley Frazier from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Point. Wildfires prove there is no time for delay in rejecting fossil fuels. By Hannah Soule. In southern Oregon, we have been living with the effects of climate change for years. Our summers are hotter, drier, and increasingly smoky due to wildfires. Smoke has shut down performances at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and endangered the health of our outdoor workers while our rivers bloom with toxic algae. But nothing makes you feel the effect of climate change bone deep like watching your community turn to ash. I'm the executive director of Rogue Climate and a lifelong resident of the Rogue Valley in Southern Oregon. After fleeing our home with our friends and families while entire communities went up in flames September 8th, my colleagues and I can say with authority that the climate crisis is here today and it's a direct threat to public health and safety. Our office in Phoenix, Oregon burned to the ground. Our region is not a stranger to wildfire, which is a natural part of the forest ecosystem, and a fire has been used by indigenous communities to care for the forest for millennia, but climate change is changing how fire operates in the West. These wildfires were a perfect storm, dry forest, strong easterly winds that pushed fires from forested areas into populated towns. Thousands of people had to evacuate their homes, setting aside concerns about the COVID-19 pandemic to stay with friends or at shelters. When it was all said and done, the fire destroyed much of the town of Talent and Phoenix and burned into Medford. More than 1,700 homes and businesses burned. So, what can we learn from this unprecedented climate-driven catastrophe? A lot, it turns out. Climate solutions improve lives now. As the winds picked up, electrical utilities were forced to turn off the power in Talent to avoid sparking more fires. Our organization, along with others, set up mobile charging stations where displaced families could charge electronics, enabling them to let frightened friends and family know that they were safe. Now our team is collecting and distributing emergency supplies, water, tents, N95 masks, and more to people who lost everything to the fires. In a world of more extreme weather, locally owned, resilient power systems driven by clean energy will be key to picking up the pieces after a disaster. Homes and community centers with rooftop solar and batteries don't have to wait for power lines to be repaired. Talent has a commitment to reach 100% clean energy by 2030 and has one of the most aggressive clean energy action plans in the state. These kinds of clean energy efforts help accelerate the transition away from fossil fuel projects that heat the atmosphere, like the massive proposed Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas export terminal that would cut an explosive pipeline through Oregon. Everyone deserves clean air. Those who didn't lose homes have still been forced to live with choking wildfire smoke that poses an immense risk to people's respiratory health. Much of the West Coast has registered unhealthy or hazardous air quality for more than a week, forcing people to stay indoors. Scientists say prolonged exposure to wildfire smoke can lead to decreased lung function, higher rates of respiratory problems, and potentially more deaths in patients battling COVID-19. Eventually, the Pacific Ocean winds will clear the smoke, and a combination of autumn rains and the round-the-clock work of brave local firefighters will put out the fires. But many communities across the country don't get to take a break from living with unhealthy air. Industrial factories, power plants, and freeways disproportionately pollute neighborhoods with a large population of Black, Indigenous, and other people of color. Here in Southern Oregon, large proportions of Latinx workers have outdoor jobs in agriculture, construction, or forestry, where they're exposed to toxins daily and can't afford to take a day off when air quality gets hazardous. Our temporary air quality nightmare is the day-to-day reality for many of our neighbors. While climate change is clearly here now, there are still better and worse possible futures, and which future we will get depends on what we do today. For decades, corporate special interests have been able to block urgent climate action despite scientists' warnings. The fires underscore what we simply can't let happen any longer. So as we show up to support our community and rebuild, we have to start implementing large-scale solutions now. It's a matter of justice. It's a matter of survival. Hannah Soul is the executive director of Rogue Climate. She wrote this for InsideSources.com. Maxwell Cathy. Cathy Lynn Maxwell, November 4th, 1950 to September 3rd, 2020. Kathy Lynn Maxwell of Council Bluffs, Iowa, loving mother of Paige Maxwell. Celebration of life, Saturday, October 3rd at Third Base Bar, 800 North 8th Street from 2 to 4 p.m. Memorials directed to Paige. Owen Timothy. Timothy R. Owen, age 43, of Council Bluffs, passed away September 24th, 2020 at Jeannie Edmondson Hospital. Tim was born October 29, 1976, in Council Bluffs to Terry and Sharon Ackerman Owen. He graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1995. Tim moved to Burbank, California in 1997 and worked in the film industry for many years and was an event planner in the LA area before moving back to Council Bluffs in 2012. He was currently working at the Strohebben Veterinary Clinic as a receptionist. Tim was preceded in death by his father, Terry Owen, in 2012, grandmother Mary Lou Owen, and grandfathers Robert Owen and Ted Ackerman. He is survived by his partner, Richard Sean Woodruck, mother Sharon Owen, sister Sandra Owen, grandmother Flo Ackerman, uncles Rick, Carol Owen, Carl, Susan Ackerman, all of the Council Bluffs, aunts Judy Gary Freeman of Wichita, Kansas, Connie David Steinhorst of Melbourne, Florida, cousins, and many friends. Visitation with the family, Monday from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer, Wittering Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service, Tuesday, 11 a.m. at the funeral home. Interment, Memorial Park Cemetery. The family will direct memorial contributions. Hunt, David. David V. Hunt, age 90, of Council Bluffs, passed away September 24, 2020, at Hillcrest Nursing Home in Bellevue, Nebraska. It was David's wish to be cremated, and no services will be held. Miller, Wayne. Wayne E. Miller, age 82, was born on November 27th, 1937, and passed away on September 20th, 2020. Memorial service will be held at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Saturday, October 10th at 2 p.m. The family will direct memorials. Freet Duane. Duane Skip Freet, age 79, passed away on September 24th, 2020 in Council Bluffs. He was born on November 14th, 1940, to the late Bus and Ruby Bailey Freet in Council Bluffs. He was preceded in death by his parents and his sister, Phyllis Milner. He is survived by his loving wife of 35 years, Patricia, daughters Sheila, Greg, Jacobs, Teresa, Mark, Evers, and Kelly, Carl, Davis. Sons, Brett, Beth, Ford, and Rod, Sharla, Ford. 9 grandchildren, 8 great-grandchildren, 1 niece, and 1 nephew. Skip served in the U.S. Navy on the USS Independence as a gunner's mate. He was an avid drag racer and enjoyed NASCAR, taking several trips to Talladega. He was a true outdoorsman and loved spending time with his family. Visitation will be held on September 29th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Hoy Konosky Funeral Home, with a military honor ceremony at 5 p.m. Lachey Constance. Constance M. Connie Lachey, aged 63, passed away on September 24th, 2020, at Oakland Manor. Born in Springfield, Mass., on May 26, 1957, to the late Ben F. Foster, December 2013, and Consuelo Laura Foster, December 2018. She was a graduate of Thomas Jefferson High School in Council Bluffs. Connie worked for the state of Wisconsin before moving back home. She is survived by her husband, Daniel J., brother Richard Foster, all of Council Bluffs, sister Mary Lou Mash of Norfolk, VA, son Stephen Baxter of Ariz, stepson James Miller, stepdaughter Jessica Miller, both of Council Bluffs, son Terry Miller of Kansas City, Missouri, nephew Tony Bacon of Waldemar, California, and niece Valerie Bacon of Norfolk, Virginia. Memorial service Tuesday at 10 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer, Woodridge Bayless Park Chapel. Connie will be cremated. Helly Randy. Randy Lyle Helly, age 65, passed away on September 15th, 2020. Randy was born on February 6, 1955, to the late Lawrence James Helly and Sherry M. Allman. He served in the U.S. United States Navy. He was preceded in death by his parents Lawrence James Helly and Sherry M. Allman, life partner Phyllis Scutro, and brother John Helly. Randy is survived by his life partner Amber Haggy, siblings Deborah Nag Unst, Ricky, Wendy Estes, Dwight, and Terry Tara Von Nosey Pat, and multiple nieces and nephews. A graveside service will be held on Saturday, October 3rd at 1 p.m. at Garner Township Cemetery, 1372 Jennings Ave, Council Bluffs, Iowa, 51503. The service will be officiated by Donald Valentine. Military honors will be performed. Derry Scott. Scott Derry was born May 14th, 1963, in Council Bluffs, Iowa, a surprise addition to the family of John and Patrina Ferrarello Derry. Scott passed away September 23rd, 2020. The family moved to Blair, Nebraska 2 years later, where Scott eventually attended Blair schools and subsequently graduated from Blair High School. Scott worked for his dad, a manager at Harold's in Blair through high school, was artistic, and attended an Omaha art school after graduation. He held a passionate interest in music and played guitar for a local band for several years. He continued his artistic and musical interest and involvement throughout his life. Later, Scott formed a special bond with Father Dan Gallus of St. Francis Borgia Catholic Church and received the sacraments of baptism, Holy Communion, and confirmation into the church. Scott is preceded in death by his parents, John and Pat, and his brother, Greg. He is survived by his special friend, Irene K. Inman, their cat, Shadow, his sisters, Connie and partner, Patrick Flynn, Cindy Dobas's Ron, brother, John Laurel, nephews, Ian Kellen and Cameron Derry, nieces, Carly and Kyle Derry, former sister-in-law Judy Millage, and numerous aunts, uncles, and cousins. Visitation will be held Monday, September 28th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Campbell Amen Funeral Home, Blair, with a prayer service at 7 p.m. Grayside service will be held Wednesday, September 30th at 2 p.m. at the St. Joseph Cemetery in Council Bluffs, Campbell Amon Funeral Home, 44 South 17th Street, Blair, Nebraska, 68008. Despite virus-related obstacles, baseball reaches postseason, by Noah Trister, AP baseball writer. The 2020 baseball season began with Juan Soto testing positive for COVID-19. Now, he's a 21-year-old batting champion after beating out another player who went through his own ordeal with the coronavirus. Perhaps it was fitting. Soto finished atop the National League with a 0.351 average Sunday, becoming the youngest person to win the battle title in the NL. The Washington outfielder outlasted Atlanta's Freddie Freeman, who hit 0.341. The fact that either player was in a position for this type of accomplishment was emblematic of a regular season that felt chaotic and uncertain at times, but ultimately reached the finish line. Soto missed baseball's season opener between the Nationals and New York Yankees back in July, but he ultimately played in 47 games and was one of the few bright spots as the defending champions struggled. Freeman played in all 60 games for the Braves, but only after a scary battle with COVID-19. He said he had a fever of 104.5 degrees and prayed for his life. There have been other sobering moments as well. Boston pitcher Eduardo Rodriguez missed the whole season after a coronavirus follow-up test showed a heart issue. But although it seemed initially that the season might fall apart because of postponements and positive tests, every team except St. Louis and Detroit managed to play the full 60 games. The Cardinals and Miami Marlins, the two teams hit particularly hard by the virus, both made the expanded postseason. Teams played for shortened doubleheaders, and the extra inning rules were different, but in some small ways, this season did feel at least a little bit normal. The Los Angeles Dodgers had the best record in baseball, no shock there. Trey Turner led the major league in hits, Jose Abreu topped the list in RBIs, and Adalberto Mondesi had the most steals. Mike Trout was phenomenal, but his team didn't make the playoffs. None of that would have seemed out of ordinary in a 162-game campaign. The postseason, now with 16 teams, could create its own wacky outcomes. The Milwaukee Brewers haven't spent a day above 0.500 this year, but they're now a well-timed hot streak from a pennant or even a World Series title. What happens over the next few weeks will go a long way towards determining how this season is remembered and how fluky it ends up feeling. For now, baseball can be relieved to have made it this far, failing short. It was another disappointing season in Philadelphia. The Phillies lost 7 of their final 8 games and missed out on the postseason. In the NL, only Colorado had a worse ERA than Philadelphia's 5.14 mark. Zach Wheeler, Aaron Nola, and Zach Eflin actually formed a solid trio of starters, but Philadelphia's relievers posted a major league worst 7.06 ERA. Trivia time. Luke Voit of the New York Yankees led the majors in home runs with 22. Who are the most recent players to lead baseball in homers with a lower total than that? There are two players who did this in the same year. One is a lot more famous than the other. Highlight. Alex Gordon played the final game of his 14-year career with Kansas City Royals on Sunday. Gordon was pulled after one inning, although he wasn't able to say goodbye to a ballpark full of fans. The rival Detroit Tigers gave him some applause. Kansas City drafted Gordon in 2005 with the number 2 overall pick, and he eventually helped the Royals with a pennant in 2014 and a World Series in 2015. Line of the week. Brandon Woodruff allowed 2 hits in 8 scoreless innings Saturday night, striking out 10 as Milwaukee beat St. Louis 3-0. Woodruff retired 19 in a row during one stretch, helping the Brewers keep their postseason hopes afloat. Trivia answered. In 1918, Babe Ruth and Tilly Walker tied for the major league leads in homers with 11. Ruth was still pitching regularly for the Boston Red Sox at that point, At the end of the 1918 season, Walker actually had a 29-20 lead on Ruth in career home runs. AP Top 25 Reality Check Big Ten Back in Pole, Not on Field by Ralph D. Russo, AP College Football Writer. There was no way this was going to turn out anything but odd, and it's not going to get easier going forward. The college football season will not have all 10 FBS conference playing until the first week, November. In the Associated Press college football poll, however, all Division I teams that plan to play in the fall are now eligible to be included, no matter when they play or how many games. That led to one strange poll Sunday as six teams, including number 6, Ohio State, and number 10, Penn State, moved into rankings without playing and with no game scheduled until late October. Clemson is still number 1, and Alabama number 2, Florida moved up to number 3. 11 voters took a wait-and-see approach with the Big Ten, Pac-12, and others. I went back and forth in what to do with those teams, but ultimately decided to leave them out until they begin play, said Ryan Aber from Oklahoma. With games being canceled each week and the no wiggle room schedules in those conferences, I want to see them play before I put them in the poll. Would have made things much easier to rank in the next few weeks in a lot of ways since those teams can't lose, but felt this was the best way to handle it. Others felt it was only fair since Southeastern Conference teams were permitted to stay in the rankings for the two top 25s released from the league kicked off Saturday. I felt it was important to be consistent, said Davis Potter of the Casper Star Tribune. Simply put, I voted for what I believe are the nation's 25 best teams as of today, whether they played a game or not. Usually, Reality Check critiques the voters' final product each week, suggesting where they might have been a little off, because that's what polls are for. That hasn't been the case this early season. Reality Check is cutting the voters some slack this season, at least for now. We're still keeping a keen eye on where teams are ranked and will call out the voters politely when necessary. For example, Reality Check was disappointed to see voters bail on Louisiana Lafayette in favor of Michigan at the bottom of the rankings. Number 1, Clemson 2-0. Next versus Virginia October 3rd. Reality Check. There is an upper tier developing in the ACCA, Miami, Notre Dame, North Carolina, Pitt, that could provide Clemson several tests before the playoff. The gap between the Tigers and the rest of the conference won't be nearly as wide as it was last season, when it was enormous. Number 2, Alabama, 1-0. Next versus number 13, Texas A&M. Reality Check. The Tide had two receivers taken in the first round of the last NFL draft and still have the best duo in the country in Jalen Waddle and Devonta Smith. Number 3, Florida, 1-0. Next versus South Carolina. Reality Check. No Florida team has ever had more yards of offense in an SEC game than the 624 the Gators had against Ole Miss. They did allow 613, though. Number 4, Georgia, 1-0. Next versus number 7, Auburn. Reality Check. Quarterback issues aside, the Bulldogs lost almost a whole offensive line to the NFL after last season. The replacements are mostly big-time recruits, but they might need a little time to get it together. Number 5, Notre Dame, 2-0. Next versus Florida State, October 10th. Reality Check. The Irish will have 2 weeks of off because of COVID-19 issues. Getting the Seminoles at home should help them kick off the rust, because that's how bad things are for the FSU. Number 6, Ohio State. Next versus Nebraska, October 24th. Reality Check. An argument can be made with just about every team not playing for a few weeks that a voter should want to see them in a game before committing. The Buckeyes are the exception. A voter can comfortably put them in the top 5. Number 7, Auburn, 1-0. Next, at number 4, Georgia. Reality Check. Tigers couldn't get the running game going Kentucky, and good luck finding it against UGA. But they'll need to get a better get better soon to have any chance to contend in the SEC West. Number 8, Miami, 3-0. Next, at Clemson, October 10th. Reality check. Want to temper the enthusiasm for the Hurricanes' newfound offensive pros? Try this. Miami is only 14th in the nation in yards per play at 6.68, mostly because of the OK 7.6 yards per pass. If there is a looming problem, it's probably downfield passing. Number 9, Texas, 2-0. Next versus TCU, October 3rd. Reality check. Whether that comeback at Texas Tech is a great escape that launches Texas to a Big 12 title or a sign of another up-and-down season is to be determined. Recent history suggests it's more likely to be the former. Number 10, Penn State. Next, at Indiana, October 24th. Reality check. Seems unlikely the Nittany Lions will get star LB Micah Parson back from an opt-out. It's a huge loss, but Penn State will seem like the team most likely to push Ohio State in the Big Ten. Number 11, UCF, 2-0. Next versus Tulsa, October 3rd. Reality check, the Knights committed 19 penalties, including 8 false starts against East Carolina, and still won by 23 points on the road. Number 12, North Carolina, 1-0. Next at Boston College, October 3rd. Reality check, interesting to see how the Tar Heels respond after 2 weeks without playing. Number 13, Texas A&M, 1-0. Next at number 2, Alabama, October 3rd. Reality check. Don't want to make too much of a sluggish victory against Vanderbilt, but it did diminish hope that the Aggies are on the cusp of a breakthrough moment in Tuscaloosa. Number 14, Oregon. Next, TBA. Reality check. The voters might be overly enthusiastic about post-op out Oregon. As of now, the Ducks have lost 3 NFL calibers defensive backs, and maybe the best player in the country in OT, Penei Sewell. Number 15, Cincinnati, 2-0. Next versus South Florida, October 3rd. Reality check. What's fun about the AAC is its two best teams are so different. Bearcats coach Luke Fickell is clearly from Jim Tressel, Mark Denatio's tree, playing a methodical game, leaning up on the defense. Meanwhile, UCF is going 100 miles per hour all the time under Coach Hissell. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, September 28th, 2020. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Ashley Frazier from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
This is Jim Ralston, and I'm with IRIS, Short Take from the Iowa Curiosities. Farmers and their toys, Dyersville, Iowa. If the wisdom on bumper stickers is true, and those with the most toys truly do win, then the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville is a winner many times over, with two floors of more than 30,000 farm toys and exhibits, ranging from row after row of common tractors to combines, harvesters, and haulers, all the way down the extensive agricultural machinery lineup to an anhydrous ammonia tanker. The museum is a shrine and miniature to the heavy equipment Iowa farmers fuss over, endlessly fix, periodically live in during planting or harvesting, and tirelessly operate to bring home the grain or the beans that bring home the bacon. And don't let the word toy fool you. The only thing toy-like about these farm toys is that they're built to 1/16th or 1/32nd scale, and don't have internal combustion engines. This is Iowa, after all. Farm machines aren't child's play, even when they're toys. Most of the toys are stunningly accurate, not to mention beautiful. Replicas of tractors or combines with particular makers like John Deere and Case, from particular years, with details accurate down to the windshield wipers. Children play with these toys not only to have fun, they got a vocational education in heavy equipment. Highlights of the museum include an exhibit explaining the notion of scale that features a full-size replica of a John Deere tractor accompanied by a row of successfully smaller scale models, from 1/2 scale all the way down to a realistically looking tractor you can carry in your pocket. Upstairs, look for more tractors and harvesters, enclosed in glass cases, more perhaps than you've ever hoped to see. And though the word toy does technically appear in this museum's name, don't expect much playing around. Tractors, trucks, trailers, and combines, even at 1/32nd or 1/64 scale, are way too wrapped up in Iowa's blood, sweat, and sorrow to be simple objects of play. Don't be surprised if you see some old-timer kicking the tires of a tiny Case combine, wondering how it would hold up harvesting more than 2,000 acres. Or some young, unquietly cussing pocket-sized John Deere because it won't turn over. The National Farm Toy Museum is at the intersection of US 20 and Iowa Highway 136 in Dyersville. Open daily from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., the museum also hosts a number of special events. Exhibits throughout the year, the largest of which is the granddaddy of all farm toy shows, held the first full weekend in November. For more information, call 563-875-2727 or visit www.nationalfarmtoymuseum.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.